So pay no attention to that spot on my shirt. I don't know if you can see it, but I spilled something right before I came in here. Okay. Radio. It's radio, people. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hello. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome. Welcome to Make Me Smart. What a surprise to see you here.
I know, right? We've been missing each other in transit more than we have been on this particular podcast.
Kind of.
Scheduled,
yep,
man.
But we're back.
That's right. What are we back with, Molly Wood? What are we back with?
We're back with Make Me Smart, the podcast where we talk about the big issues in tech, the economy, and culture, but not today. Oh, no. Well, I guess, actually.
Well, kind of, but yes, it's what
today,
you guys think are the big issues.
All of the, right, you have chosen the issues. Right. We will endeavor to come up with the answers because we are back with Explain-a-thon.
Honestly, this is my favorite thing that we do. Honestly, it really is. Which is not,
really
that
is.
Not that I don't love them all and, you know, electric-powered airplanes and, you know, nuclear power and all that stuff, but I love this. I think it's great.
Yeah. This is... Yeah. We love it so much. It's the sixth one.
All right. So,
yes.
So here's the way it goes. We play some of the voice memos you sent us. We answer the questions to the best of our abilities. And if you stump us or we just can't, then you hear this. And that's us saying, Tony Wagner, you got to help us out.
Help us. That's the pass to Tony sting. It means that Tony, our digital producer, will have to do a little research and find the answer to your question. Because for those of you who are new to the Explain-a-thon, I should point out now, we got these questions, 18 minutes ago.
Yes.
Like, we're not allowed to do the usual smooth duck-duck-go sitch and get all prepared for what's about to happen.
So
good luck to us.
All right.
Let's begin.
Mike in New Jersey, you get the first one. Go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
Hi, Mike.
My question lies at the intersection of the trade war, the election, and the dueling technology ecosystems emerging between the U.S. and China. Chinese tech companies may receive implicit or explicit support from Beijing. So if the big American tech companies are broken up, would they be at a competitive disadvantage compared to their Chinese counterparts?
Wow, that's interesting. There's like 14 leaps of logic in there, right? Because that assumes Elizabeth Warren wins and breaks up Facebook and all the rest. But... interesting
or
question.
That Josh Hawley is weirdly successful.
Well, that's right. So
yeah,
I'm gonna let you go with this one. Go.
Well, yes, it does assume a lot of things, such as that the tech companies would be broken up. And I think if you look back at the history of companies that have been broken up in America, even going back to antitrust, like let's say AT&T, still pretty powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still a company that's doing fine. Microsoft had some Department of Justice intervention, shall we say, a lot of distraction that, yes, allowed Huawei, the phone maker, to pull ahead of Microsoft, which biffed it at making phones, but again, still among the most valuable companies in the world. So you're assuming that breaking up these companies significantly damages their businesses in some way. And then as to the question of their Chinese counterparts, as we are recording this, Senator Josh Hawley, who I just mentioned, is having a bit of a temper tantrum because TikTok, the Chinese owned social media sensation, has refused to send a representative to testify about his concerns over TikTok's sort of national security implications. So I think even if you had tech companies be broken up, you would also have this increasing scrutiny of their Chinese counterparts who are increasingly being locked out of this market, much like U.S. tech companies are locked out of the Chinese market. So it's possible that we will retreat to some situation which is similar to what we've been in already, which is that you would have parallel development of giants who may someday leap out from behind their respective walls and fight each other like a Godzilla movie, but I don't think that we would necessarily see tech company.
Oh my goodness! That last little bit kind of threw me a little bit. Can we take
two giant monsters like being bred in different parts of the?
Did you ever see Pacific Rim? Pacific Rim was a really good movie. I really like
Pacific Rim.
It was so good. Okay, wait. Can we take a 60-second TikTok diversion here for a second?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
We have talked about it before briefly. Certainly in our editorial meetings, maybe on the podcast, I don't know.
And we did
basically
a whole episode.
Did we? Was I there?
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. And my gist was, what the hell is this thing for, right? And I should tell you, I've since, I've used it quite a bit. I've gotten on it, videos, yay, fun, whatever. And I deleted it this morning for two reasons. One is because it's a time suck, because you're always like, okay, what's the next video? And I'm like, I don't have time for this. Number two is this whole security thing, which is now becoming apparently more real. Discuss. You got 30 seconds.
I just want to talk about how the fact that you've been on this on the TikTok all this time and we didn't even get a chance to see the videos and now it's gone.
I didn't do any videos. I just watched them. You kidding me? Me going on TikTok? Get out of here.
I mean, honestly, I am a little surprised that it's taken this long for the United States to wake up to the TikTok situation. Yeah. Because the guest that we had on, I think Make Me Smart, but it could have been Tech, basically told us that, hey, the Chinese government maintains an office in TikTok headquarters. Like, imagine if the FBI had an office for information sharing based in Facebook.
Yep.
I mean, some people argue that they do because the whole Peter Thiel CIA thing, but separate.
That's a different thing.
TikTok is unquestionably, you know, data gathering about our kids. Like, it has all this access to the young generation. And my son was telling me just this morning that there is a game being played on TikTok where all these people put up pro Hong Kong videos and wait to see how long it is before their accounts are disabled.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all kinds of
accounts.
Yeah. No, I know. And there's all kinds of American election stuff going on and Make America Great Again. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. Anyway. All right.
Yeah. That is one to watch, that story. Yeah.
Okay. All right. What's next?
All right. Next up, a question sent in by Christina Roberts, and it goes like this.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Every employer I've had who has offered a 401k match does it on the basis of percentage of my salary. If I contribute 5% of my salary, they will match 3%. This seems unfair to lower income level employees and is giving people who already make more money another advantage. Plus, with the wage gap, women and people of color are getting penalized twice. Why is this a common practice? And are there companies that have matched programs that are more equitable?
So I actually had a conversation along these lines, not exactly about this, but along these lines with human relations here at Marketplace World Headquarters a number of years ago. And they basically said, look, the law requires that we treat everybody the same when it comes to these retirement programs because they are tax advantaged. And it's the tax code. It's not the corporate practice. So that's that. And as to whether companies that have match programs that may be more equitable, there certainly may be. I don't know them off the top of the head. But the baseline thing is that it's the tax code that requires identical treatment. So there you have it.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Fascinating.
Yep.
I will say, and this is where I always learn from our listeners, I had never thought of it that way.
No, me neither. It's a really good point.
That it was sort of essentially regressive in that way, which is a really good point and something that, I mean, that's the noise to start making vis-a-vis the tax code, I guess.
Yeah, of many noises to make.
Okay. Good point.
All right.
Good point.
One of the folks who listens in the Midwest is wondering whether the technology innovations in transportation right now could wind up leaving some of us behind. And here's the question.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Justin from Hannibal, Missouri.
Hannibal Mo.
Molly mentioned in passing the rising cost of vehicles. My question is regarding the future of transportation in rural America. Electric vehicles are practically unusable for large areas of the United States. Ride sharing as a model will not work either. Will the changing landscape of transportation in metropolitan areas further drive up the cost for those of us in rural middle America?
Yeah, I think this is really, I mean, you guys and the evenly distributed type questions. Here's what I actually suspect because, it could go one of two ways. The positive possibility, let's start with the good news.
Okay.
The good news is, traditional car makers are going to be under a lot of pressure if transportation significantly changes, right? If more and more people start to migrate to rideshare or start migrating to electric vehicles and they're still making the good old gas kind or start just eschewing car ownership altogether. Like that is the future that car companies have been preparing for. And there is an argument that cars could get cheaper because demand will go down. And then that would be good news for those who live in areas where you really do need to have a car and drive. And then there's the alternate reality where they just stop making or they make fewer and fewer and fewer cars. And then you are highly dependent on the electric vehicle infrastructure actually getting built. Like we are hearing so much about how the electric vehicle infrastructure is totally happening. And it is totally happening up and down the West Coast of the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really actually unconscionable for it to be progressing as slowly as it is in the rest of the country. I completely agree with you.
Right. And if you own an electric car of whatever variety in Hannibal Mo, it's going to be tough for you to charge it up, right? That's the name of the game.
And it is. I mean, it is. It's fascinating. It's not. Ugh. I was about to say it's not surprising, and then I feel like that's so nihilistic, but all of the projections for the beautiful technology future all assume that we live in mega cities.
Yeah, for sure.
They all do. And that's not necessarily, why should that happen? Right. There's a whole lot of wonderful usable land that we should be living in. There are huge infrastructure questions that we still have to answer, without a doubt. Okay.
Mark, Florida, go.
Can you please explain fair tax so everyone can get on board? Thanks.
Nope.
Dude, man, it's like a half hour podcast.
No problem, Kai, you got this.
So look, the federal tax code is tens of thousands of pages long. The idea of a fair tax would basically get rid of all of that. It would get rid of taxes on capital gains. It would get rid of taxes on income. It would get rid of payroll taxes, Social Security. It would get rid of all those taxes and replace it with a tax on consumption. You buy a good or a service and you pay a tax. And that's the way that would work. It, in theory, is more equitable. It's generally considered to be more progressive. It gets rid of all the loopholes that let Warren Buffett pay a lower percentage of his income in taxes than his secretary, or a lower tax rate than his secretary, as we famously heard 5 or 8 years ago. But look, I mean, yes, the move toward a fair tax has some proponents, but the idea that that's going to happen anytime soon, I don't think is real. A little bit like modern monetary theory, actually.
We're doing that show. That is the thing.
Okay.
I do not have that power, okay, to be clear, listeners.
Yes. sure.
Does the fair tax fall into the same trap as the 3% match on 401k, though, where it turns out to be regressive by accident?
By accident, because what happens is lower income people have to spend a greater proportion of their income. Period, right?
Right.
So if you've
on
got
taxes.
Yeah, exactly. So if you need to buy bread and you have to pay,
I see.
Right?
Yeah.
You pay X percent of your income for bread, which is more for a lower income person than it is for Jamie Dimon or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, right? Mm-hmm. So there are certainly some kinks, unintended consequences. Yeah.
So if their tax burden is the flat 2% or whatever it is,
right?
It's still a disproportionately higher burden. I guess I've been trying to figure out why the fair tax is more progressive. I guess because it gets rid of loopholes.
Yeah.
But
the idea is that it flattens things out, not in the tax bracket category, but in the everybody pays it, and that's the deal.
Yeah.
There's no scooting around it, and you can hire as many tax lawyers as you want, and you can't find a loophole. In theory, right? I mean, come on.
Oh, well, yeah. Rich people are super good at loopholes.
Right.
Let's be
right.
clear. All right. We need a break.
Yes.
Not to Google things. We're not allowed. We're just kidding. But to pay for the show.
Yes.
We are going to take a short break. We will be back with more of your questions. If you are inspired to write in with your own questions, follow-ups, answers, corrections, clarifications, things of that nature, makemesmart@marketplace.org is where to send it. We'll be right back. We're back. I don't know if there was a delay there, and I don't know why I made that noise, but hello, we're back. We have more questions. More questions! We were informed by our producers during the break that we're answering them kind of quickly, which I don't know if that means we should give them more thought, but I think we're doing great. Our next question has to do with the trade war in China, but it is a little different from the first one we answered, and it comes from listener CJ Flint.
Hi. I'm CJ Flint from Tallahassee, Florida, and I've got a question about the trade deal we're negotiating with China. I read that the White House has proposed a currency pact with China, and I really don't know what that is. So I hope that you can make me smart. Thanks.
Wow. Okay. So the big sticking point, well, let me rephrase that. One of the many sticking points between the United States and China as we go through this trade war is how the Chinese government values its currency, right? Because the Chinese yuan, sometimes called the renminbi, people's currency, does not trade freely. The Chinese government sets its exchange value within a certain narrow band, and it stays there because that's the way the government lets it trade, literally, as opposed to the dollar, which anybody can buy or sell in whatever quantities, and that is a market-based pricing system. The idea of a currency pact with the Chinese government would focus on that exchange rate. Because if you've listened to the president when he talks about tariffs and how the Chinese are paying, which parenthetically, because facts matter, they're not. One of the things the president says is, oh, they devalued their currency, so the Chinese are paying. And really what the president and his advisors are trying to do here is to get the Chinese to voluntarily give up one of the tools they have, valuing or devaluing their currency, to deal with U.S. tariffs. This would be part of the phase one deal that has been much talked about in the press. Not too many details have leaked out. I frankly would be super surprised if the Chinese agree to this because it's a really big structural issue for them. But that's the deal. It would be all about the U.S. getting the Chinese to agree to some sort of controls amenable to the United States controls on the renminbi or the yuan, if that makes any sense.
I can tell you that when you do sneakily look that up on the internet while Kai is talking, you find many experts who are saying, much like Kai just said, that seems highly unlikely.
Because it's a huge tool for them. And there's, I mean, you know, why would they give that up?
And this is the part where the president is always saying China is a currency manipulator.
And yet, he says it, but doesn't do anything official about it. Sorry, that's just a minor monetary pet peeve of mine.
Is there an official thing to do about it?
Yeah, there is. Treasury Department actually makes a declaration and the whole deal. Yeah, and every year since forever, the Treasury Department has said, oh, no, you know, we're not doing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because it would provoke...
Yeah, because then it gets really ugly.
Heaven
then
forbid
you've got
a trade war?
Paperwork that says so, yeah. Totally.
Oh, no. Yeah. Are there other currency manipulators? I mean, what is that? So it's just paperwork? Does it say, like, we're not going to do deals with you?
There are sanctioned, not economic sanctions, but there you can be sanctioned if you are a currency manipulator, yes.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good to know. Look, we got double smart.
There you go. All right. So this next one is from David Segelnick. He's in Plainfield, Indiana. Been through an explain-a-thon or two, as you'll hear.
Hi, Kai and Molly. And Tony over there in the booth. Get ready, Tony. You're going to be part of this too. My question is not so much if we're going to hit a recession, but when we hit a recession, how are we getting out of it? My problem here is there's no real room for quantitative easing. We can't do a stimulus like last time because our deficit is already $1 trillion a year and growing. And if the Fed keeps trying to shave the interest rate to keep the economy moving and it suddenly falls on its nose, we won't be able to do a big 2 or 3% interest rate cut to get us back on track. So, if we don't have any of these ways available, what is the other answer to getting out of a recession with any kind of due haste?
Aha, key phrase
Tony,
right there. Yeah.
Cue the dark sting.
No, 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 no,
no, no,
no, no, no, no.
He's
no,
not
I
in charge.
I reject that dark sting. I reject the dark sting. Couple of reasons. So look, he raises some really good points, but let's take the last one first. That whole idea of due haste. The thing is, you really do want to get out of a recession as early and as soon as you possibly can because it damages economies and it damages lives, right? And we saw that in the Great Recession. And let's be clear here. The next recession is not going to be the Great Recession for a lot of reasons. But you do want to do it. You want to get out of it as fast as you can. Now, let's go through some of his items. Number one, QE, quantitative easing. That's the big Federal Reserve bond buying program that Ben Bernanke embarked upon as we were getting out of the Great Recession. The Federal Reserve buying up mortgage-backed securities and all kinds of things and flooding the system with cash, getting more cash out there. Now, the Federal Reserve has actually recently under Janet Yellen and now also under Jay Powell begun to trim its purchases and narrow or trim down its balance sheet. There's no reason they can't if the feces hit the rotary oscillating device, buy more bonds. I mean, they certainly can, right? Is it ideal? Mm-hmm. No, but they can totally do that. Let's see. Thing number two, what did he say? Stimulus. Yes.
Stimulus.
So, our deficit is $1 trillion a year, thanks, we should say, in very large part to the GOP's deficit finance tax cuts, because we're borrowing more money to pay for those tax cuts. So debt is a big problem. I would say, though, that if the economy really goes down the toilet, you will see some kind of stimulus program be passed. Not as big as it ought to be, but they never are. Look at Obama's in February and March of 2009. But there will be a stimulus program because nothing makes Congress more scared than people realizing that Congress is doing nothing about the economy in a time of great need. Right. And then on the interest rate cut thing, that's actually really interesting. And it's been sort of a thing I haven't actually really understood. So Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve are cutting interest rates to keep the economy going. Sustaining the expansion is the phrase Powell uses because that's a good thing, right? Keeping the expansion going. The catch, of course, is that they don't have a whole lot of room between the, I don't even know where they are, percent and a quarter-ish or so on the federal funds rate and what's called the zero lower bound. That is to say, putting interest rates back down at zero. Remember when the Great Recession started, the federal funds rate, which is the primary short-term interest rate the Federal Reserve controls, was at like 5.5%, maybe 6%. And they had a whole lot of room on the downside to make money cheaper, get stimulus into the economy, get people borrowing, and thus spending. Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve don't have that room now. They've only got a percent to play with, plus or minus. And that's actually really a problem. So is it a Darkstone problem? No. Is it a thing we need to keep an eye on? Yes. Because, just to get back to the top of the question, and then I'll stop talking, it's not a matter of whether there's going to be a recession. It's just when. And right now, nobody knows. There we go. That's what I got.
Also, it's when and how severe, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Because
for sure.
If our economy like slows down, I mean, so far, everybody keeps saying fundamentals.
Yeah.
Yes, there are lots of global forces that are pushing in the warning direction, but consumer spending is really strong. Housing is really strong. You know, I mean, there's sort of all of these things that suggest there's not a lot of other places for money to go to. So like the stock market's still strong. Investment is still an opportunity to make. Perhaps you're getting the gist that I met with my financial advisor this weekend.
Oh, did you? Good for you.
But you know, I mean, generally speaking, he's pretty bullish on the economy.
That's reasonable.
The American economy overall, and was talking about like as we're waging, he is of the opinion that the trade war with China needs to be waged, which is an opinion that is shared
by a
lot of people, right? That there have been manipulations from China, like propping up the businesses and stealing intellectual property and all of these things that have needed to be addressed on the global stage for a long time, and that we are using our strong economy to wage that war. That the time to do that is when the economy is really strong, and that, in fact, cutting interest rates to keep the expansion going gives us more power to sort of wage these battles and hopefully give – this is sort of the long play version – but hopefully give an equal playing field to American companies – on the global stage so that we have sort of more success. It's like it feels like a long play trickle down argument, but it was interesting.
Yeah.
I had not heard it put that way. And I thought it was interesting, but we did have Neil Irwin to talk on that time to talk about how we don't have like a lot of tools.
Yep.
So hopefully it's not a bad one. Anyway, not Darkstone. Come on now.
Yeah.
All right. Donna from East Lansing with a question about something we talk about all the time, all day, every day, internet privacy, heaven help us. Specifically, Donna wants to know about the creepy background check websites where you can look people up and find a lot of personal information about them. Did you know about those? They're out there.
Yes.
Hey, Make Me Smart. This is Donna from East Lansing. What's the deal with sites like MyLife.com, Intellius, Spokio, and probably others? How are they able to get all the information they have on us, and why are they all opt out? And challenging to do with that. Would something like GDPR shut this down elsewhere? And how can we get that here in the US? Please make me smart.
There you go.
These are like, I know. I mean, this is the data economy that nobody knows about and never talks about in some ways. It's like all of these data brokers who are gathering and selling all this information. And a lot of it is publicly, I mean, in the case of an Intellius or a Spokio or MyLife.com, I mean, look, this is the consequence of when you didn't realize how much information was publicly available and then it all gets put in one place and you go, wait, what? I mean, I've heard people say that like if someone were to invent the idea of the phone book now, that people would freak out, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, you are going to put my name, home address, and phone number in a book for anyone to look up?
Remember that? That's so funny. God.
Totally normal.
Yeah.
Everyone had it.
Wow.
And it still exists on the internet in the form of Intellius and Spokio and MyLife.com. And, you know, and then it integrates like publicly available arrest records or housing records or things like that. So the simple argument is that it's really hard to opt out of that unless we fundamentally change what we consider to be publicly available data about people for the internet age, which is interesting, should maybe be done, and is probably very low down on the priority list. I don't think GDPR would necessarily do anything about it. I think these sites probably aggregate way more information than the publicly available information. Mm-hmm. But in this case, that's what they're working with. And it is a nightmare to get out of that system. I found a Reddit thread that I will pass to Tony or to our digital producers and we'll put it up. But it's an amazing thread that takes like 25 of these and provides the link to opt out of each one.
Wow.
But not a link, all 25 links. Like you have to do it one at a time. It's insane. I agree. Great. It's insane.
Right. Kate Wang, ready, go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. If so many of our economic indicators were based on when we were a manufacturing and agricultural-based economy, what types of new indicators should we have to reflect a service-based economy? Would they reflect qualitative experiences of how good the services are? Would they have to better reflect how services move across borders and use the internet more flexibly than old goods and manufacturing products?
Well, we talked a little on the show about the idea of an innovation metric for GDP.
Yeah.
Right?
I was just going to say we'll get back to you on that one. Because that's actually a thoughtful question that I don't have an answer to.
Yeah.
You know?
Ah, there
true.
We go.
Sure. I know that was passing the buck, but I don't have a good response for that one.
And I like that. Yeah. That's a good question. That's whole show in one question. God, you guys are so smart.
Yeah. No kidding.
Okay. This next question will either be the easiest or the most difficult, depending on who's answering it. I mean, depending on how you look at it. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Allie from Baltimore. Could you explain, especially given all the dark places we've been going to recently, what it is that gives you hope for the future? Thanks.
Well, that was a cheery little thanks at the end of that one, wasn't it?
Good luck. Have fun with that.
Thanks, Allie from Baltimore. All right, I'm going to let you go first.
The past.
Oh, what a good answer.
The past gives me hope for the future.
Oh, my God, what a good answer.
I can't believe you didn't come up with that. You're
the
history guy.
I'm the history guy.
Yeah. I mean, listen, like, at a minimum, Earth will persist. But
well,
certainly
until
people
it gets
will.
Too hot and we all die, what kind of thing is that to go to?
And then Earth is good to go. We're out.
Yeah, humans are out. That's right.
I actually fundamentally, I know this is going to sound crazy, believe in human ingenuity. I really do. Like, I think that we have figured out a lot of problems throughout our history. We've done terrible things, but recovered from them and done better things in the interim. We have, you know, we were on the brink of extinction when either the aliens intervened or we figured out like fire and agriculture. So I don't know. I think long term we're okay. And actually, again, things are pretty good for more people in the world than they ever have been. We got this.
I'm going to let that sit right there. I got nothing to add.
All right.
Got nothing to add. We're going to close, as we always do, with the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Elizabeth Owens has the answer this week. Here it is.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I thought I knew that Rube Goldberg was an inventor, some quirky little guy in a workshop making these complicated machines where a cuckoo clock chimes and then 12 steps later the dog gets fed. But I just found out that I have been wrong about that for almost 4 decades. He was not an inventor, he was a cartoonist. And he came up with these really elaborate cartoons or these machines in these cartoons to make fun of like politicians and academics who would create these super complicated ways to solve fairly simple problems. So the whole idea of this Rube Goldberg machine comes from a cartoon, not from an actual inventor. So, the more you know. Thanks, guys. Love the show.
What?
Well, there you go. Who knew?
That's amazing.
Who knew?
Also, the idea of it as an actual metaphor, which is how it's used, that's so awesome. I love that stuff. All right. Okay. Challenge is on you, listeners. Beat that. The question again. Yep. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? And as you have seen from our answers, they can span the gamut from From life to awesome trivia. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Thanks for all the voice memos and the good questions. We'll see you next week.
So by my count, we only owe an answer on one of them, right? The economic indicators one? All right, that's not too bad. That's not too bad.
I know. And that's or an episode.
Yes.
Either an answer or an episode. Yes. I thought we did great.
Yep.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. They're the ones who chose all these thoughtful questions today. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. He's on the hook for, you know, producing an episode. No big. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hathcote and Summer Dunsmore.
This week's program was engineered by Jay Siebold. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And I guess that's what we got.
I guess so.
There we go.
I guess so.
That wasn't terrible.
Stuff.
No, you did not.
I did, just a little bit.
Cheater pants.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.